Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at the geopolitics of oil. My guest today says we're at the beginning of a 15 to 20 year window in which, thanks to alternative drilling techniques, we can rather painlessly reduce our dependence on oil. That's reduce, not eliminate. She says, though, thanks to those techniques, we've bought ourselves some time. Ambassador Molly Williamson is a specialist on energy, economic, and demographic factors affecting foreign policy and U.S.-Middle East relations. She's currently a scholar with the Middle East Institute, a frequent guest lecturer at Johns Hopkins University World Affairs Councils and the National Joint Staff College. She's a former Foreign Service officer, having served six presidents in four different cabinet departments, achieving the rank of career minister. She was a senior foreign policy advisor to the Secretary of Energy from 2005 to 2008 with global responsibilities at Foreign Policy and Energy Policy. From 1999 to 2004, she was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce. In the 1990s, she was a Principal Deputy and then Acting Assistant Secretary of State for International Organizations. And in the early 90s, she served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, responsible for the Middle East, Africa, and South Asia. She's had numerous postings in the Middle East, including Chief of Mission and Consul General in Jerusalem during the Madrid peace process. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this week, and I spoke with her while she was here. Molly Williamson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we think about the geopolitics of oil, I think most knowledgeable people look at this big tectonic shift from the West really making the decisions about oil and energy to those decisions increasingly shifting to the East, to the emerging economies of China and India, where you have these huge emergent middle classes that have been promised and are fully expecting Western standards of living. What does this do for the oil equations over the next 10 to 20 years?
The key for so many of the emerging economies is both the symbol, the status, the reality of automobiles. And with that comes all of the infrastructure development. So it's not just cars and more gas stations. It's roads, it's street lights, it's spas, it's hotels, motels, all of the marketing that goes with a huge shift. It also gets to larger issues of how you use land, how you use water, how you use other commodities, and it also gets to the movement of people. So we're seeing this. We're seeing this in two big growths of the Chinese economy, the Indian economy. We're seeing it also growing in Latin America and in Africa. Ultimately, the African market is going to come on gangbusters at some point.
So what does this do for the way we have sort of sorted out energy decisions in the world so far? I mean, the United States basically calls the shots, at least as far as production and demand. You know, we've made those decisions. Increasingly, we're not.
Well, it is the case, you're right, that demand growth is increasingly coming from places outside the United States. But it is still the case that today, for example, the whole planet consumes 89 million barrels of oil, and that's true every day. We are the single largest consumer. We consume just about 18.5 million barrels of oil a day. China comes in second at about 10.5. And the fact that we are still the largest consumer means that we're still the largest customer for the oil suppliers as well as for the decision makers. But it is changing. You're quite right. And that change has to have reactions and accommodations from the traditional consumers, which have largely been the West. So if we decide to change our consumption, it doesn't necessarily mean that the price drops, for example, at the pump. If the demand is elsewhere, that'll keep the price up. And that changes how we plan, how we invest, how we produce goods to the marketplace, and whether or not our own economic reliance on a healthy supply of energy is affected. And so the plans, all the discussions that that you see all around the world about how to be more energy efficient, how to expand the universe of fuels so as to be able to provide or to lessen the pressure on traditional hydrocarbons so that there's enough for everybody since the planet is growing no matter what we do.
Yeah. You mentioned the fact that, you know, and most people see this, that China and India, just those two economies, but Africa mm-hmm. as well, Latin America, they're going to soak up any excess supply that there is. In fact, they're going to keep demand pressures high.
Right.
Any sense that we're willing to change based on, you know, the mid-2000s, we had a spike to, I think it was around $125, $130 a barrel. In 2008, just before the collapse, it got as high as 152, 34, somewhere around there. That's major price spikes. And, of course, we saw after the economic collapse, $150 oil to $30 oil.
Right.
Crazy.
Right.
You know, any sense that American consumers and American businesses and the people that can make a difference in efficiency are really making changes?
It's happening. It's happening in ways that are so omnipresent we don't even feel it. Does that make sense?
It's I think cars are probably one.
You know,
how long did we have debates on CAFE standards
right.
where we couldn't get automakers to budge even 1 mile per gallon, and now all of a sudden they're touting vehicles that are 30, 40, 50, even 50 miles per
Today,
gallon.
Today, you can't even buy a car that only gets 20 miles to the gallon.
Maybe a huge truck. But even a huge truck is getting better.
The efficiencies that we are seeing across industries are something anybody could be proud of. We are looking at better efficiencies in the way we build buildings, both residential and large commercial buildings. Our insulation is better. Our use of energy is better. We are, in fact, using less to do more. I mentioned we're at over 18 million barrels a day. 3 years ago, I would have said we're using more than 20 million barrels a day. So we're actually using less. We're being more efficient, but we haven't changed our way of life. People aren't giving up cars and going to buggies. It's not like that. We are, in fact, becoming a more efficient society. Our appliances, those Energy Star appliances, nobody knows what the star stands for, but they know it's good. And the Energy Star standards are getting tougher and tougher every year, so that an Energy Star refrigerator today is lots more efficient than an Energy Star refrigerator of 6 years ago, 10 years ago. So it's happening. We are also becoming more conscientious in terms of not only the efficiencies, but in what we use so as to keep some of the pressure from growing on conventional hydrocarbons, which are overwhelmingly necessary for the transportation sector, cars, trucks, jet planes, and the like, which means we're using more in the way of non-oil for electricity generation, which is huge for us, and we now have a gigantic benefit in the shale gas and also tight oil that is coming onto the market to further relieve some of the pressure on traditional hydrocarbons.
Now, we've heard a lot of, and especially this part of the country, we hear a lot about these new drilling technologies, fracking and horizontal drilling, and the ability to recover more oil from these old formations, as well as some of the shale formations. Is this the panacea that we've been led to believe, or is it mainly a hedge against this increased demand from the rest of the world?
I think it's not a panacea. It's just a wonderful gift of abundance. And this allows us to build a bridge. But build the bridge we must, ultimately, to a post-petroleum era. Doesn't mean we give up all petroleum. To the contrary, all the projections are that for as far as the eye can see, this planet is going to be heavily dependent on coal, oil, and natural gas. So this isn't going to happen anytime soon. But to relieve some of these pressures by coming up with additional supplies or even areas of supply benefits the entire planet, because some of that volatility in the marketplace that we have witnessed even in the last 20, 30 years is a function of supply suddenly becoming so tight, prices so high, that the cure for high prices is high prices. People then pull back. And that creates a huge swing of prices, of attitudes, of recessionary behavior that is profoundly unhealthy for any economy, much less as a global adventure. So what we are seeing now is this advent of a tremendous abundance because the fracking technology is American. We're sort of first off the blocks and using it well. There are risks, water quality, air quality, and seismic activity, all of which are eliciting both industry fixes, regulatory fixes, and scientific and technological fixes. So nobody is saying this is an unmanageable basket of risks. But ultimately, as we make it possible to use this technology safely and productively for the benefit of the planet, we need to use that time that we're buying to build that bridge to create yet more technologies, yet more opportunities for alternative sources of energy to help grow this planet.
If somebody came from outer space and landed in the United States in, say, 1978 or 79, they would hear about energy efficiency. They would hear about the era of cheap oil is over. Mm. If they came back in 1995, 1997, 1998, they say, what planet was I on? Because I think this is one of the key lessons we're going to have to take is you're talking about we have this time. We had another era like this from the oil shocks of the 70s. 10 years later, we're driving Hummers.
Right. The real challenge, and this is something that has a label, and in fact, it's been called the curse of oil, and it has applied to a lot of resources, not just oil. But the thesis is people suddenly feel like, oh, they don't have to worry about this anymore. They've got this incredible abundance. This is going to carry them. This is the sustainable key, and all that sort of stuff. And then they don't invest in the future. They don't invest in building the bridge to the next technologies. And when the time comes, then they risk obsolescence. So the curse of oil then also robs the existing economy because people keep thinking they've got easy supplies. People don't work as hard to develop the innovations that we need.
I think even a stable oil price sort of engenders that sort of thinking. But just because as long as the price is stable, you know, oil will creep up a little bit, but you don't have the shocks, which tends to be a part of the market.
Right. People will try not to worry about things they don't think they have to worry about. And they will also try to not worry about things they may have to worry about. People don't like to worry. And so they comfort themselves into thinking that it's okay and we'll manage. We'll manage for a while. And what we have is this opportunity. And the bottom line is to not waste the time that we are being given by virtue of this incredible abundance.
So how can we avoid the mistakes that we made in the 1980s and 1990s when a boom of drilling at that time and a boom of new production coming back online from the Middle East, depressed prices, and all of a sudden we had a war in Iraq and Kuwait that, you know, it didn't disrupt prices. In fact, prices went down lower actually after that. And we just totally missed the boat on this long-term trend. How do we avoid that mistake in this sort of era where unconventional production and new techniques are giving us another window?
I think you're right to fear the prospect that we might just wipe our brow and heave a wonderful sigh that we're past that other crisis and now we can just relax and take it easy. This is going to take leadership. It's going to take commitment. It's going to take time. No matter what we do, it still takes 20 years to grow a teacher. There's no way of saying we can just throw money at this problem, however we define the problem, at the 11th hour. We have to develop the technologies. We have to look at our priorities in terms of education. The young people who are going to be the innovators are going to need to be nurtured, to be brought along, to think about things we cannot today identify as problems. That's a real challenge.
My guest today is Ambassador Molly Williamson, a scholar with the Middle East Institute. She served as a foreign service officer through 6 presidential administrations and in 4 different departments. You were in the State Department, but you were also in Commerce, Energy, and Defense over the course of your career. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on the geopolitics of oil. I was listening to some of your presentations over the last couple of years, and you said there are really 3 important things we need to do, and we kind of briefly touched on the first one, which is energy conservation and efficiency. And certainly when you look at appliances, when you look at even auto standards, we're making great progress. There is one area where we haven't made much progress at all, and that is in transportation in general. We're still depending on gasoline.
Right.
And when we aren't completely depending on oil-derived gasoline, we're basically burning food and corn-based ethanol.
Right.
What are your views of changing this transportation? Because this is the area where we're the most inefficient, right?
Right. And more than 90% of everything we import in the way of oil goes to the transportation sector.
So we're doing pretty good at electricity.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. We're doing very well in electricity generation and so on. And part of that is the growth in natural gas that we're using. But the energy density of petroleum kind of can't be beat, and that's really, really tough. That's what keeps people looking at it. There are some developments, you're right. The biodiesels of ethanol, the problem there is we've got to get out of the food chain. You know, that is chicken feed and cow feed and
people
and
food.
People food. But there is greater use of cellulosic, which is the corn stover, the stalks, the cobs, the waste, the organic waste, but not the food.
Now, Brazil is probably the other country that we think of, and they're using sugar cane.
Right.
Well, that's bad for you anyway.
Well, the thing about sugar cane is that there are some places, not just in Brazil, I think there's been some discussion of this in Indonesia as well, where people are actually shutting down rainforest in order to grow sugarcane. Well, that's also
a bad trade-off.
Right. So the biodiesels are certainly something that is being looked at. There's a lot of talk about hydrogen. People love the idea of hydrogen cars because the byproduct is not a global emission of carbon dioxide, but water vapor. The problem there is it takes roughly 3.5 gallons of gasoline to make enough hydrogen to go the distance of 1 gallon of gasoline. So that project needs more work. Mm-hmm. People are working on it. There is also the notion of relieving some of the pressure on traditional petroleum base by looking to more gas.
CNG,
indeed. And that technology already exists. And there are cities throughout the United States that have buses, municipal buses, saying this bus runs on clean natural gas, for example.
Not only in Tulsa do we have buses like that, we also have cars, a lot of and more cars converting to CNG.
Right. And this is going to be a huge wave in the future. Right now, the biggest problem is infrastructure. It's not the technology. We already have it. We know how to have CNG engines. And
we have plenty of supply.
And we have lots of natural gas.
You talk to any natural gas producer around here, they would they're just praying for CNG conversion.
Give me the market. I can supply it. Yeah. Exactly so. But the issue right now is the infrastructure. So you're on the Jersey Turnpike and you're driving along. Where do you pull over to get your car filled up with more natural gas? And the building out of our infrastructure is a huge, huge issue in the United States. We have for a very long time, for far too long a time, ignored the need to both maintain and expand and modernize our infrastructure. Everything, pipelines, refineries, electricity transmission, everything, not to mention highways. And so the people who do the build out for a living, the people who plan what it takes to build out our infrastructure to be more capable of getting the product we are now producing, we're producing so much gas, how to get it to market. Right now, we don't have enough in the way of infrastructure. We're using rail cars. We're using trucks to get our products to market. And, oh, by the way, that drives up the price of the product. Never mind that wonderful highway etiquette for which we are all so famous.
Yeah.
But the people who specialize in that say we need 10 to 15 years to build out our infrastructure before we can take advantage of this incredible abundance. So we've got the technology. We've got the supply. We need to build out our gas stations, our, you know, outfit a national network to be able to make the switch.
Well, and this gets back to what seem to be dirty words in our current political discourse, incentives, subsidies to make that happen. And throughout our history, going back to building a railroad across the country, the government took a role in this. And government helped make these things happen. Government built interstate highway systems when gasoline was plentiful. Why not the political will to make something like that happen? Or on the other side, besides everybody driving their own CNG vehicle, maybe we have public transportation and, you know, rail lines, commuter lines and metro lines in all American cities, so that you are taking that pressure off. There seems to be no will for that either.
Well, you're right. There are innovative urban planners who would love to hear more of your words as inspiration and also as a means of better public information about what we can do to accommodate the planet's increasing demand for more energy. We have the ability to meet that increasing demand. We need the leadership. We need the commitment. We need the time. Even if we were to start today and there were a miracle, it would say, yes, we can have more pipelines, more refineries, more transmission lines, more modernized roads and outfit all the gas stations, which generally speaking have gas now to some extent, to make it possible for cars to embrace this abundance, it's still going to take 10 years. We've got to make that time commitment. That's not a campaign cycle. It's not an election.
It's more than one president, even if they serve 8 years. And that's probably the biggest detriment right there. Not that we need a president that serves more than 8 years, but you know, the outside limit of our timeline in American politics.
We have a lot of folks in the political game who tend to worship at the church of re-election.
Every 2 years, yeah. Your third point was investing in innovation. Mm-hmm. And this is another thing. While we have this period where these new drilling technologies are going to give us this window, that we have to start investing for a post-petroleum future. I think even most oil professionals realize that. They just want it to be 30, 40 years down the road instead of 20. But we have to do this.
Right. For as far as the eye can see, and by that I mean more than 50 years, this planet is going to be heavily reliant on the traditional hydrocarbons of coal, oil, and natural gas. Making a switch that embraces other fuels doesn't mean you stop day one and day two you're on something that's not petroleum. To the contrary, I see this as something that will continue for a very long time, that can easily take us into the next century. But the blend of fuels available to be used has to grow if we are to accommodate a growing planet with growing standards of living, which is part of what we want because that implies greater stability for the planet. To have more and more countries that are either failed or failing states is only going to add to volatility, not to stability. So how we get there from here with that commitment of time, with that commitment to invest in innovation, to build that opportunity for the future, because nobody knows what it's going to look like, is where we're very short of the mark. And we are also looking at some other shifts in the planet. It is, for the first time in the history of the planet, an increasingly aging planet. Not just the developed world, but all of the world is showing a growth in the aging societies, that this has huge ramifications for urban planners because they tend to see this development producing more in the way of cities. It's going to affect the way economies work. It's going to affect labor markets. And all of that requires more planning, more leadership, greater intent and commitment.
You know, this gets to the sort of other leg that people never talk about. You know, we've talked about population increases, but we're really, you know, we talk about the pyramid of peak oil. Mm. There's going to be a pyramid of peak population too.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely,
we're not to the crest anywhere yet, but it's in sight.
Absolutely. Now, we're seeing that all over the world. This is not unique to any one country or any one part of the spectrum of social organization.
And this will also play into what we've been talking about as far as energy needs. And really, energy needs help fuel that hastening to the peak, because if living standards are improving, which is a big part of energy needs, then all of a sudden there's a less need to have large families.
Well, and we're going to see more of what we have known as traditional fuels being used, perhaps more efficiently as well, but nonetheless being used more than ever before. So all the more to grow that universe, develop a larger augmented universe of energy supplies.
So one last question. We've talked about this period that we have. It could be fairly stable as far as energy goes for the next 10 to 20 years because of these unconventional techniques that are becoming commonplace. How good are we at managing this imperative at this particular point? Are we, you know, not very good, or are we really making some important strides?
I think we're making some important strides, and we're also untested in the spectrum of issues facing us. While I would like to say that things are not as volatile as they were, say, 10 or 20 or 25 years ago, the fact of the matter is we're looking at a planet in which roughly two-thirds of all the known reserves of conventional oil and gas reside in an area called the Middle East. The Middle East is not in a stable place right now and is not likely to emerge from its period of turmoil for some time. It's a very tough time. So while I say on the one hand we need 10, 20 years to build that bridge to the future that's going to embrace more than just traditional hydrocarbons, we are looking at that same time frame in increasing volatility, which happens to house the majority of the traditional hydrocarbons. So it's possible that the two clocks we're on, the one in the Middle East, which nobody can control, and the one trying to consciously build for the future, about which we have a little bit more control, aren't in sync at all. And that could very well make the process of trying to build this bridge volatile without intent, but simply because the traditional resources are facing a tough time, while simultaneously the emerging economies are demanding more.
It'll be very interesting to see. I appreciate your time today. Molly Williamson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Former Ambassador Molly Williamson, a scholar with the Middle East Institute, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this week. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.